Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Stephen Burke, the Henry and Sally Schaefer Professor of Holocaust and Jewish Studies at Union College in Schenectady, New York, former chairman of the Department of History, director of the program in Russian and Eastern European Studies, and faculty advisor to the Jewish Student Organization. He is the author of Year of Crisis, Year of Hope, Russian Jewry, and the Pogroms of 1881 to 1882, published in 1985 by Greenwood Press. Dr. Burke will speak on the topic, Our People Are Your People, American Jewry, and the Struggle for Civil Rights, 1954 to 1965. His remarks were given as the annual Phil and Ruth Sokoloff Lecture, co-sponsored by the Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, November 1st, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Moshe Gershovich, the director of the Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies.
Professor Burke has been a consultant to the Wiesenthal Holocaust Center at Los Angeles. He has also written articles on Russian and Jewish history, on anti-Semitism, and on issues related to the Middle East. He has lectured throughout the United States and Canada, including such distinguished colleges and universities as Princeton, Vanderbilt, and the University of Texas at Austin, as well as William College. And now, of course, we are privileged to have him here at UNO. Professor Burke is frequently consulted by the media, including the BBC. He is considered an absolutely superb lecturer and teacher. His class on the Holocaust is considered the most popular course offered at Union College. Among his many awards, in 1986, Professor Burke received the prestigious Holocaust Memorial Award from the Holocaust Survivors and Friends Educational Center. And in 2010, he was distinguished as Israel Hero for the defense and advocacy of the State of Israel by the Jewish Education Resources of New York. And now I'm going to hand over to Dr. Burke.
Thank you very, very much. It is a pleasure, an honor for me to be here. This is an absolutely beautiful campus, and I have been very, very impressed by the people that I've met and the things that I have heard. In the spring of 1963, a group of rabbis were in a Baptist church in Birmingham, Alabama. Outside of the church were hundreds, if not thousands, of white men and women who were screaming all sorts of obscenities against the black people in the church. At that period of time, when people were quaking in their boots and their shoes in the church, a rabbi got up on the altar and said to everyone, "Our people are your people. We Jews stand with the black community." I tell my students, on the first day of every class I teach at Union, you cannot explain the present by the present. Everything has a history. And so if I concentrate on the period 54 to 65, you'll permit me to go back a little bit further, about 100 years to be more precise. Jews marched with John Brown, but they didn't like him. The Jewish community didn't like him. John Brown fought for a noble cause, but John Brown was a murderer. Jews reacted, let's say, in a very hostile way to this. The traditional Jewish political position has been, be very wary of those who resort to violence because of a well-experienced fear that the violence would eventually turn against the Jews. In addition to that, the abolitionist movement was a bit too Christian for the Jewish community. So what took place is what one could expect. That is, Jews outside of the South were opposed to slavery. Jews inside the South were just like the overwhelming majority of Southern whites. They supported the institution of slavery. The irony here is that probably the most famous rabbi of the time, or one of the most famous rabbis of the time, was a German Jewish Reform rabbi who comes to this country and ends up in Baltimore. In Baltimore, he speaks out against slavery. His congregation will be furious, and he has to be really snuck out of the city in the middle of the night. So it is a rabbi in Baltimore that speaks out against slavery. The best paid rabbi, perhaps the best paid cleric in the United States, was Rabbi Morris Rofel in Manhattan, who received the munificent salary of $2,200 per year, making him probably the highest paid cleric in this country. And this man, Rabbi Rofel, actually gave a biblical defense of slavery. He was repudiated by other rabbis in the North and by, let us say, some of the prominent Jewish intellectuals of the time. In the North, Jews fought in the Union Army. In the South, of course, they fought for the South. All sorts of people got involved. Judah B. Benjamin, a very, very brilliant man, first Secretary of State, and then Vice President of the Confederacy. In the period after the Civil War, you don't find much Jewish involvement in what today we would call the Civil Rights Movement. The problem, of course, was, what do we do about all those East European Jews who are coming to the United States? This is not the most glorious chapter in Jewish history. Just to give you a point, or make the point here, large numbers of Jewish Americans, or American Jews, let's not get hung up on the semantics, most of whom were from Germanic Europe, looked with contempt and scorn on the so-called Ostjuden, the Eastern Jews. You see it in the minutes of a Reform temple in Manhattan that kept its minutes of its executive committee meetings in the German language well into the early part of the 20th century. You don't have to know a single word of German, not even a single expression in Yiddish. When I tell you what the expression was, it just doesn't sound right. That is when the Balabatim, that is when the leaders of that Reform congregation spoke about the East European Jews, they were referred to as a, quote, a schmutzige Leute, a filthy and dirty people. A Jewish newspaper in Chicago said what we need from the Jews from Eastern Europe is a little bit less Polish and a little bit more polish. I'm simply making the point to you that Jewish concerns were in other places, in other issues. And then there was something else. Anti-Semitism has been a problem for Jews, as one historian in Israel, Robert Wistrich, puts it. Anti-Semitism is the longest hatred. Jews confronted anti-Semitism in the United States in the revolutionary period. But sometimes, after a while, you get accustomed to it, and the question is not whether or not anti-Semitism exists. Plato was right, to paraphrase him. Plato once said, only the dead have seen the last of war. Only dead Jews have seen the last of anti-Semitism. But Jews got accustomed to it, for the issue is not whether it exists, whether it impedes the Jewish entrance into the mainstream. Jews got frightened because of an incident that occurred right near my where I live now, in the nearby very beautiful city of Saratoga, when one of the wealthiest Jews of the land, Joseph Seligman, came for a vacation to take the waters in Saratoga and went into the Grand Union Hotel. And Mr. Hilton said, we do not rent rooms to people of the Hebraic persuasion. If it could happen to one of the wealthiest Jews of them all, what does it mean for everybody else? And then the East European Jews come. They vote with their feet for the United States. And that is going to really, really involve most American Jews. What do we do with them? How do we settle them? And so on. But by the early years of the 20th century, things began to change. And if any Jews had any illusions that this was a country in which everybody gets along, what shattered them was the lynching of a Jew. So when this Brooklyn Jew who lived in Atlanta, Leo Frank, is accused of murdering and perhaps sexually assaulting 13-year-old Mary Fagan in his pencil manufacturing plant, and then when he is convicted by a kangaroo court, and then when the governor of Georgia, Governor Slayton, a good and decent man looking over the evidence, comes to the conclusion that he really is innocent and therefore the death penalty should be commuted to a life sentence, hopefully with the passage of time, new evidence would come to, in fact, acquit him. But that was not to be. Because in that penitentiary in Milledgeville, Georgia, a group of bigots, white bigots, would storm the prison, take out Leo Frank and lynch him. And they would do to him what they had done countless times to black men in the South. That is, they would take photographs, they would take pieces of his body, they would mutilate the body, and again, it would have a resounding impact upon the American Jewish community. The American Jewish Committee, the Anti-Defamation League of the B'nai B'rith, would all swing into action. They couldn't do anything to get Leo Frank free. That they couldn't do. But they would turn their attention finally to that other group that had suffered so much in the United States. They would suddenly become sensitive to the plight of black Americans. And so, in the years just prior to World War I, a number of American Jews, nearly all of whom were of German extraction, would now begin to, they wouldn't use the term civil rights, but would begin to do something to ameliorate the plight of black Americans. What is it that they would do? Who are their names? To this day, when the NAACP gives an award to that individual who has done most for the cause of civil rights, that award is called the Spingarn Award. That's named for Elias Spingarn, a professor of English, a Jewish professor of English at Columbia University. His brother Arthur Spingarn, a prominent attorney, would create the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and would begin that slow, inexorable process of ameliorating the plight of black Americans. And into this would also come the Jewish plutocrats, the two most famous of them, Jacob Schiff and Julius Rosenwald. And along with them, probably the most prominent Jew of the time, probably up through the third decade of the 20th century, the great attorney Louis Marshall. These are the men that now would play a role in creating, in helping create, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and the Urban League as well. So what I'm trying to convey to you here is the Jewish plutocracy, that small group of very wealthy Jewish bankers, financiers, were beginning to get involved in what we would call the civil rights movement. Now, there has been some, I must say, controversy here. A number of scholars have said they didn't give a damn, those Jews. They didn't give a damn about black people. They were only interested in eliminating prejudice. That is, again, the sum of the scholars would argue, that the Jews seemed to understand that a country that would accept black people would eventually accept Jews, get rid of anti-black sentiment, and will be good for the Jews. Personally, I think there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing, let's say, ignoble about that. If a Jew who is educated had a brain in his or her head in the teens, the 1920s, and the 1930s, if that Jew had a brain in his or her head, and if by this time the overwhelming majority of Jews were of East European extraction, they had to see the analogy. They had to see the resemblance. Attacks on black Americans were very similar to pogroms. That probably more than anything else is what led a growing number of Jews to support, again, that civil rights movement. I spoke to you about the top, the Jewish plutocracy. But at a lower level, there was even more substantial involvement. Outside of African-American newspapers, who, of course, were publishing all of the evils that were perpetrated against black Americans, The only other group of newspapers that made the plight of black Americans front page material was the Yiddish press. That is, those Yiddish newspapers within Manhattan. Again, all of them, the Fovitz, the Allgemeine Journal, that is their Tag, whether they were socialist or moderately socialist, whether they were right-wing or left-wing, there were always articles about the lynching of black Americans and the very serious situation in which they were in. It is also true, it should be pointed out, that the first unions to integrate black workers were the Jewish unions. The ILGW, the Amalgamated Fur Workers. These were the unions, the fur, all sorts of organizations. Working class organizations began to integrate blacks into the union movement. And so as we come into the interwar period, we find growing numbers of Jews supporting, again, what would be called later the black civil rights movement. But this is not hagiography that I'm telling you. And this is not a lecture in Jewish chauvinism. Was there racism in the Jewish community? You can bet your last buck on it. After all, I told you where I come from, and I am of a certain age when I remembered. When I remember when it was said by people very close to me. When is the Schwarzer coming? Now, I know some Yiddish, I know some German, and I know that the word Schwarzer literally means a black person. But it's got to be a cold day in July before you can convince me that that was a term of endearment. It was not. It was a racial term. So anti-black sentiment or Jewish racism was not an oxymoron. Jews as white people benefited enormously from American society. To be somewhat cynical and moving to a parenthesis, one of the reasons that Jews have done so well in American society is because we have been covered, we Jews, by an umbrella that is composed of Latinos, black people, and Asians. This is a wonderful country in which we live. It really is. And nobody can testify to that great more than the Jews. A people scorned in the rest of Europe and the rest of the world comes to America. Absolutely remarkable. But one of the reasons that we have done well here is that because when our compatriots, our countrymen, when they really get nasty and when they really get angry and ugly, they hate primarily, not exclusively, but primarily on the basis of race. By virtue of being white, Jewish Americans have done very, very well. But I am saying to you that with each passing year, a growing number of Jewish Americans would begin to sympathize and would begin to help their more unfortunate black compatriots. Now, I move quickly now into the 54-65 period. Everybody knows about Brown versus the Board of Education, right? That great trial before the Supreme Court, in which, of course, segregation is overturned. American history has never been the same since that time. Everybody knows about Mr. Brown, a courageous black man who will not stand anymore for his daughters not being allowed to go to an integrated school, to another school. But there's another Brown there. There's another Jewish. There are a number of Jewish components here. Mr. Brown is convinced to take it. He knows where he is in Kansas City. He knows he's in an ambiance that is not particularly favorable. So it's a middle-class Jewish housewife by the name of Esther Brown who raises money for him and directs him to the NAACP in order to bring this to trial. And then every student of the Supreme Court knows that those who were in favor of overturning segregation on the court knew that it could not really have an impact upon American society if it was a 5-4, 6-3, or even 7-2 vote. It had to be a unanimous vote. And students of the Supreme Court have often said that the man on the court who is most responsible for bringing about a 9-0 vote, was the Jewish member of the court, Felix Frankfurter. And the third issue that I'm sure you're all familiar with, for those of you that have the long memory, today psychologists will say it really wasn't a very scientific experiment. But do you remember, if you have the long memory, if you study this in class, Kenneth Clark, remember, the black psychologist with the white dolls and the black dolls, and the young black girls are asked, who do they identify with? And they identify with the whites, demonstrating a sense of inferiority, that separate but equal does not really create equality. The money for those experiments comes from the premier Jewish organization of the time and one of the great Jewish organizations that still exists, and that is the American Jewish Committee. So in the 1954 Supreme Court decision overturning segregation, there is a substantial Jewish component. In the aftermath of that, as we all know, things will move because the court in another decision will say we should move with all deliberate speed, which means that we should move with glacial slowness. There are people, of course, who are going to say that is not enough. And again, I jog your memory, or if you took a good course in political science or in American history, you know about the Freedom Riders. 50% of the white Freedom Riders were men and women who were Jews. An absolutely astonishing figure. And then in the early 60s, we begin to see greater challenges to the movement. Let me move in seriatim, as they say. Let me deal with the rabbinical response. Southern rabbis are quaking in their boots, and they have all the reason to be very, very nervous. Shortly after Martin Luther King Jr. spoke at the temple in Atlanta, a bomb exploded in the temple. A number of Protestant pastors, white, that is whites, in southern states, who had spoken out in behalf of the Supreme Court decision, would lose their positions and be threatened with violence. Why shouldn't Southern rabbis be so nervous? And simply to make the point to you, I give you the names of some of these rabbis who are very courageous. They are the exceptions. Jacob Rothschild in Atlanta, Charles Mandelbaum in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. But to give you an idea of what it was like, I give you the name of Rabbi Emmett Frank. Emmett Frank in Alexandria, Virginia, who receives a call one day. He had spoken in a sermon against segregation. He picks up the phone and he says, now I know that I never use the language, except you gotta use it. I don't mean to offend anyone, but it makes the point if he used the original language. You nigger-loving kike. If you don't stop talking the way you are, we're going to come into your house and we're going to cut the eyes out of your children. Frank would go within a half hour to the nearby television station with a shotgun and say over the air, anybody comes into my house, I'll blow your brains out. No coincidence that Frank would spend some time in a mental institution. Not a joke. The pressure that these people were under was absolutely tremendous. The Southern rabbinical position, the decent Southern rabbinical position, was with a decent white Protestant and white Catholic position. That's what Martin Luther King Jr., the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., revolted against. That famous letter from the Birmingham jail is addressed to those clerics. They are telling him, we are with you. We're with you. We know that segregation is wrong. We know the oppression that black Americans are suffering under. But give it time. And that great man, Reverend King Jr., says, we've given you time. How long are we supposed to wait? In the North, it's a different story. Northern rabbis are going to, and by North, I mean everywhere outside of the South, they are going to rally to the anti-segregation cause, to the cause of civil rights. I am a member of a conservative Jewish congregation, the conservative movement. but I must concede the point and confess to you, this is the shining hour of Reform Judaism. More than any other branch within the Jewish community, Reform Judaism went out and fought the good fight. And it wasn't only rabbis. The leader of the social action community is a man who is now about 90 years old, as vigorous, as tough, and as articulate as he was then. That's Al Vorspan. Along with him, Rabbi Lelyveld, who gets his brains bashed in Mississippi. They go to St. Augustine, they go to Florida, they go to a whole host of, and Mississippi, they go to a whole host of places. And it was said, just to make the point to you again, it is, you were, when I was introduced, I hold this chair in Holocaust and Jewish studies. I am a European historian by training. When you read about the American South in the period before the 1960s, you are reading, you are immersing yourself into something that seems like a foreign country. We are talking about a time when people in the Senate and people in the House are talking about niggers and kikes. That's the language they are using. That's in the sacred halls of our democracy. So the point here in all of this is, again, for Southerners, Southern white Jews, Southern rabbis, a difficult time, some people showed courage. Percy Nussbaum, the Reform rabbi in Jackson, Mississippi. Now, I will give you the name. If you're familiar with the history of the civil rights movement, it will resonate with you, but it seems like a million years ago. Where did they take all of those freedom riders? Where did they take all of those students, blacks and whites? When they arrested them, they put them in, you remember the term, the Parchment Prison. Remember that? Not a good place to be. And it is Percy Nussbaum, the Reform rabbi. Doesn't speak out much from the pulpit. But he goes to Parchment Prison. He brings the money. He exchanges letters from the parents, from the students, from their parents. So there's courage in the South. But for the most part, Southern rabbis would take a low-profile position. In the North, they come down. Reform rabbis are imbued by, the prophetic tradition. What do I mean when I talk about the prophetic tradition? In every synagogue in the world, on the morning of Yom Kippur, every synagogue in the world will read the prophet Isaiah. Yom Kippur is a fast day. And what does Isaiah say? God told me to tell you and to tell the Jews of all time. Now, it would be chutzpahdik to say that what I'm about to tell you were God's words. I'm paraphrasing. You got to forgive me. So here, Isaiah says, God told me to tell you on this fast day. You can fast from today until doomsday. I will not listen to your prayers. You can wear white. You can take off your leather shoes and wear sneakers. I will not listen to your prayers. When will I listen to your prayers? When you feed the hungry, clothe the naked, take care of the widow and the orphan. That's Jewish social ethics. That's what those rabbis are responding to. And everything is a question of time. We'll come back to this in a moment. This is the early 1960s. Less than 20 years after the end of the Holocaust. Those rabbis remembered the Holocaust. When 6 million Jews are wiped out on the grounds of their racial inferiority and their racial evil. A Jew could not stand by, say those Reform rabbis. And in fact, it's not only the Reform, the conservative movement also plays a role. After all, it's a conservative rabbi that gets up there in that Baptist church and says, our people are your people. But perhaps the most emblematic rabbi of the time was one of the leaders of the conservative movement. That's Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Heschel marches with Reverend Luther King, Martin Luther King Jr. in Selma. And it is Heschel who makes that famous statement. It was easier for the Hebrews to cross through the Sea of Reeds than it is a black man. It is for a black man to get a library card in Mississippi. So the rabbis are going to participate. Some of them will be beaten, but it's a shining hour for the American rabbinate, but particularly, again, for the Reform rabbis. But it's also a time when it would elicit a positive response from some American Jewish young people. Now, I don't want to lose you here. This becomes a little bit more complex now. In 1962 and 1963, the civil rights movement, led by SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and CORE, but particularly by SNCC, had come to what is an interesting conclusion. We are trying to register blacks. We are trying to educate them. We're getting our skulls beaten in, and nobody is going to pay any attention whatsoever. So the argument in the autumn of 1963 is, in SNCC, you know what we got to do? We got to call, they don't use the term a crusade, we've got to really have a Mississippi summer. Bring down large numbers of students from the North, a large number, if not most of them, will be white, and if those white kids get beaten up, then the press and then the government will pay attention. And that is exactly what happened. Over 800 young men and women come, probably somewhere between 35 and 45% of them were Jewish. They come down south, they participate in voter registration, they help form the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, that is a party distant, divorced from the regular Mississippi Democratic Party, because it wouldn't allow blacks to participate. They create schools, community centers. It is a noble enterprise, but it is a painful one. They are right, those leaders of SNCC. People are going to get hurt. Three young men are killed. Two of them are Jewish, Schwerner and Goodman, and a young black man, James Cheney. The wrong place and the wrong time. In other words, again, I think a substantial Jewish commitment. Why did they go? That's always hard to find out. We have the testimony of some of these people later on. They write their memoirs. They give oral testimony. Here's what comes back. Here's a name you should remember. A good, decent kid from Brandeis University. This is Mendy Samstein, Yehuda Mendel Samstein. He leaves Brandeis, becomes a field secretary for SNCC, and he does, in the words of Stokely Carmichael, he was one in a million. He is one of the leaders, one of the paragons of the American Jewish community. And then there's another student at Brandeis. You'll remember his name, because most of us later on thought he was as loony as a fruitcake. And the answer is he probably was. That's Abby Hoffman. Abby Hoffman is seeing on television that the house where Mendy Samstein was staying in Mississippi was blown up. He sees Samstein crawling through the ground, and Abby Hoffman says, I'm not staying at Brandeis anymore. I need some action. And he goes there. Alad Lowenstein. Again, names from the past. These are the Jews who go. Samstein will say, and his wife will say after he died, it was the Holocaust that did it. Never again should a Jew stand by when a racial group is stigmatized and destroyed. In addition to those students who go, lawyers will go. 50% of the lawyers from the different national legal organizations that go to the South are men and women who are Jewish. 60% of the physicians that go South are men and women of Jewish extraction. So in terms of soldiers of the civil rights movement, there is a Jewish component here, a very, very important Jewish component. But would you believe that the father of neoconservatism, Irving Kristol, whose son you now see on Fox News once in a while, Irving Kristol was one of the foremost intellectual champions of civil rights. And so too was another man, another founder of the neocon movement. That's Norman Podhoretz, the man from Commentary magazine. Again, the shift to the right takes place somewhat later for different reasons. And then there is Irving Lewis Horowitz, the professor of sociology at Rutgers. Sociologists and anthropologists played a very important role in the civil rights movement. It began with one of the greatest anthropologists of the 20th century, Franz Boas. Boas and others would attempt, and successfully, of course, prove what was provable, that black people were not inferior to white people, that they were not intellectually inferior, they were not morally inferior. The sociologists and the anthropologists would do a good job in disproving all of those terrible myths. And then the money men. The civil rights movement was a war against the status quo. What did Napoleon say in the 19th century? The same thing what von Clausewitz had said in the 18th century. Money is the artery of war. Money was the artery leading to victory in the civil rights movement. And it is, not only, but in a very important way, American Jewish money that plays a role in the civil rights movement. In the best book about CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, the authors show that CORE had a list of contributors. Who were the highest ones? The specials and the extra special specials. These were what we would call today in philanthropy the heavy hitters. More than 70% of them were Jewish. That money is important because when Martin Luther King Jr. is put in prison, when the civil rights workers are put in prison, somebody's going to have to raise the money for bail. That's what that Jewish money and other money is going to do. And then there are the key personnel. These names you should know. They are important. Sometimes they are forgotten. They are very, very important. When you receive a solicitation in the mail for a political candidate, you know who you should thank? You won't thank him. You'll curse him because of that. That's one of the great heroes of the civil rights movement, Stanley Levison. According to Reverend King's best biographers, Levison was the closest white friend that Martin Luther King Jr. had, and probably the most reliable confidant, black or white, that he ever had. Stanley Levison was a vice president of the American Jewish Congress, an attorney in New York. He embraces, literally and figuratively, embraces Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. He helps write his speeches. He helps write his books. He helps prepare his tax returns. And because he has a house on Cape Cod, he invites Martin Luther King Jr. to come there as well. This is the man that provides, one way or another, most of the money that goes for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. That is very, very important. But Stanley Levison has a problem. It's the 1960s, the late 50s and the early 1960s. Stanley Levison, one Hungarian Jewish historian put it this way. There is something called the fatal magana, the fatal temptation of Jews. The fatal temptation of Jews is the left. And in the 1930s, like thousands if not tens of thousands of Jews, Stanley Levison moved to the left and probably became a member of the American Communist Party. He distanced himself and left the party. But this is the early 1960s. This is the time of J. Edgar Hoover. This is the time, that's why Martin Luther King Jr. is wiretapped. To be sure, J. Edgar Hoover doesn't like the civil rights movement. But he sure as hell doesn't like it when he finds out that Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. is talking to, not a former communist, but in Hoover's eyes, a communist. And he's going to bring great pressure. Bobby Kennedy is going to bring great pressure upon Martin Luther King Jr. to distance himself from Stanley Levison. But only to a certain extent will that distancing take place. Levison is really an important figure in the ultimate victory. And then there's Harry Wachtel. Harry Wachtel, the Wall Street financier. Harry Wachtel's got a daughter in Brooklyn, a teenage daughter, who says to him, "Hey, Pop, these are turbulent times. Are you doing anything else besides making money?" That's real chutzpah for a teenager to say to the father, right? But that's what she said. He's embarrassed. He opens up Wall Street to Reverend King. He opens the doors of Washington to Reverend King. Now, I must say to you, no black leader before or since Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. has ever elicited the positive response from the Jewish community that indeed Reverend King did. It's often forgotten. Reverend King was a champion of the State of Israel. He defended Israel at almost every moment. And Reverend King was one of the first leaders, black or white, outside of the Jewish community to speak in behalf of Soviet Jewry. And because he was nonviolent, the fact of the matter is that too would appeal to the Jews. So there is Stanley Levison. There also is, again, Harry Wachtel. And then there's a much more mundane man, Marvin Rich, the American representative, an American. He represents Histadrut, the Israeli labor unions. He's married to a black woman and becomes caught up in the civil rights movement. He is one of the great fundraisers of the movement. He works for CORE. Wachtel, Levison, and of course Marvin Rich. And then other men. Sometimes, watch out, I'm in a university campus. I've been with my colleagues for 46 years. Do not be offended, Rob, but for those of you who are my colleagues here, do not be offended. Sometimes American intellectuals just don't have that clout. One of the reasons being, please do not be offended. Do not be offended, my colleagues. I can tell you. I won't speak about the University of Nebraska at Omaha. I'll speak only about my place. And I will tell you that every crackpot idea rejected by the American people is alive and well in faculty lounges. That I will tell you. That I will tell you. So the fact of the matter is that American intellectuals, academics, have an impact but a limited impact. It is left in the early 1960s to a number of men, two men in particular, who will have enormous impact, and they're not university professors. One of them was a piece of work, if there ever was one. This is the old crank, some people would call him, from Charlotte, North Carolina, Harry Golden. Harry Golden put out a newspaper, The Carolina Israelite. Most of the readers were not Jews. Harry Golden had a good sense of humor. He talked about vertical integration. That is, at Woolworths, they don't want to let you sit down, so everybody should stand up together. Or, in his attitude towards religion, it has nothing to do with civil rights, but it's an interesting anecdote. Harry Golden's father was what in Yiddish would be called an apokoros. He didn't believe in God. But every Saturday morning, every Shabbos, he was in shul. So Harry Golden asked the old man, "Hey, Pop, I know you don't believe in God. Why do you go to synagogue every Saturday morning?" And old man Golden says, "You know my friend, Mr. Schwartz?" And Harry says, "Yeah, I know Mr. Schwartz." "Mr. Schwartz goes to the synagogue to speak to God. I go to the synagogue to speak to Mr. Schwartz." Which I suspect is true for many of us down to the present day. So the point here is Harry Golden, a Southerner, is able to get a good response from moderate Southern whites. And moderate Southern whites is not an oxymoron. There were many people, whites in the South, that knew it was wrong, it had to go, but didn't have the courage or wanted more time. Harry Golden tells them it's the time. And the other is a more sophisticated man. This is Charles Silberman, a writer for Fortune magazine. Silberman writes the most important bestseller of 1964. You may remember it. It's still a good read. Crisis in Black and White, in which Silberman says he knows how to go for the jugular. He knows which buttons to push. This is the Cold War. And so what does he say to the American people? We are engaged in a life and death struggle with the Soviet Union. Most of the world is composed of people of color. How can we win these people of color over to us if we practice this terrible system of segregation and discrimination? And he talks about what's being done in the cities, the alienation of black men and women and children. Again, an important contributor. In short, by 1964, we are in the high tide of the Jewish-Black symbiosis. It will never get better than that, and the fact of the matter is, it's downhill from then. It's downhill very quickly now, because we want to finish before Shavuos. That's a Jewish holiday that comes in May. So let me tell you what you already know. First of all, there's a tremendous amount of frustration in the African-American community in the civil rights movement for two reasons. One, those students that I talked to you about that went South, Jewish and non-Jewish, white students, in many cases in the South, they began to take over the civil rights movement. They began to write the press releases. They began to dominate the movement. And blacks justifiably said, "This is our movement. Why are you taking it over?" That was one thing. The second point was that they were getting their brains bashed in. And there really wasn't much change. Now you look back and you see the success. But then, for those of you who are political science people or know your political history, you know what the great turning point was? Not only in the civil rights movement, but in American political history. It's the Democratic Convention in Atlantic City. That changes everything. There used to be a time when it was the solid Democratic South. That's going to change because of the Atlantic City Convention. Black leaders come with Mendy Samstein from SNCC, the white Jew. They come to Atlantic City and they want to be seated in Atlantic City, the delegation from the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, not in lieu of the regular Mississippi Democratic delegation, which was based on a segregated vote. And Lyndon Johnson is worried. He's worried that if he allows them to sit, he's going to lose Mississippi. He's going to lose the South. The debate gets so heated that Mendy Samstein, the white Jew, turns to one of the great black heroes of the civil rights movement, a man as decent as the day of long, That was Bayard Rustin. Bayard Rustin was a good man. Bayard Rustin had suffered. But Bayard Rustin is prepared to take the compromise that is offered to him by Lyndon Johnson, Hubert Humphrey. The compromise is this. We'll seat one member of your Mississippi Freedom Democratic delegation. But in 68, we will not seat anybody from Mississippi unless it's a fair and open primary. Rustin says, take it. And Samstein yells out, backed by other blacks from SNCC, "You're a traitor, Bayard." But the compromise is accepted. That changes American politics. Because when the Democratic Party allows or stipulates, mandates that they have to be open primaries, the blacks come into the Democratic Party, the newly enfranchised blacks, and whites move out. They move to the Republican Party. The entire course of American political history is changed by that. And what, of course, does the bitterness again breed? Stokely Carmichael says, "We don't need any whites here. This is the time for black power." So Michael Lesser in Louisiana, field secretary for CORE, Mendy Samstein and other Jews, not because they're Jews, but because they're white, are actually thrown out of the movement. That's going to harden the Jewish attitude towards the civil rights, not so much the civil rights movement, but to the black civil rights leaders. And then the riots. The riots in Watts. The riots in Washington, D.C. The riots in Harlem, 125th Street. The Jews, what's one of the most famous books in American Jewish history? You haven't read it? It's a good book. The book is entitled When Harlem Was Jewish. Harlem, up until the 1920s, was a Jewish enclave. Most of the people living in Harlem were Jewish. The blacks come in, the Jews leave. But the Jews own the department stores. The Jews own a good deal of the houses. You don't have to be a Sigmund Freud to figure out that there's no love lost between tenants and landlords. When you put on top of that, that the landlords are white and the tenants are black, and some of the landlords are Jewish, you can see the tension. And then, again, to understand this, you must put yourself back in place and time. What's the revolution in American Jewish life? It's the Six-Day War. Again, the most difficult thing for a historian to do is to recreate the ethos of a period. Just to make a point, very quickly. If I were lecturing to you about John Kennedy, and I said these were the achievements of John Kennedy's administration, believe me, it would take me no more than 2 minutes, if it would take me 2 minutes. But would I be doing justice to Camelot? Would I be doing justice to that remarkable time, that remarkable man, and his remarkable wife? The answer is no. Why do I mention this? Because for those of you that have a long memory, or those of you that only know about this, in late May of 1967, Gamal Nasser, the leader of Egypt, said, we're going to push him into the sea. We're going to reverse the stain of 1948. We're going to exterminate the Jews. The Jewish community is worried. And when some young black leaders came out on the side of the Arabs and opposed the Jews, that was a problem for a number of American Jews, for a large number of American Jews. And that was followed, of course, by the great teacher strike in 1968, when there was anti-Semitism on the part of some elements of the black community and racism against blacks on the part of some of the Jews. And then 1979, Andy Young, the American ambassador to the United Nations, the highest ranking black person, African American, within the State Department, is removed. Because in secret, whether Jimmy Carter told him to do it or not, that remains an open question. But American policy at that time was not to negotiate with the Palestine Liberation Organization, and he held talks secretly with them. He's forced out. A number of black Americans are going to be very, very upset with that. And then, a man that has always been enigmatic for the Jewish community, a great man, a man of courage, a man whose politics are too far to the left for me, but nonetheless, you must give him his due. This is Jesse Jackson. So in the early 1980s, Jesse Jackson has an interview with a black reporter from the Washington Post. And what does he say? He refers to New York City as Haimi Town. Now, from a Jewish standpoint, if the worst thing that was ever said about New York City was Haimi Town, but again, everything is a question of perception. Many of us got very upset in the American Jewish community, and his apology simply did not resonate well. And then there is the issue that continues down to the present day. I'm a Russian and Soviet historian by training. So you know who I'm going to quote for you? Joseph Stalin. A murderer if there ever was one. A man who never had anything good to say about anybody. But he has one good statement. Stalin used to say, history towers over the present like a mountain. It's always there. In our personal lives and our collective lives. So when leaders of the African American community and members of the American government begin to argue for the need for affirmative action, this is the way to redress the grievances of the African American community. You've got to include them. You've got to give them preference. You've got to do certain things. A Jew who's got a brain in his or her body knows. We know where the black people are coming from. They've suffered. They've been excluded. We can understand this. But on the other side, some people in the African American community didn't understand where the Jews were coming from. You know why so many of you are here in this room if you are Jewish? Most of you, I suspect, can trace your antecedents back to Eastern Europe. In Eastern Europe, there was a numerous clauses, a quota system. That is, in the Pale of Settlement in the Russian Empire, in any high school or university class, no more than 10% of the class could be composed of Jews. Outside of the Pale, it was 5%. In Moscow and St. Petersburg, it was 3%. For many Jews, affirmative action was a quota system. That is, they took the logical step. Whether it was logical or not, it's a matter of debate. If you begin to say that 15% or 12% of a medical school class or a university class should be composed of black people because that's their percentage of the population, the Jewish fear is, by the middle of the 1960s and the 70s, the percentage of Jews in the United States was hovering around 2%. Does it mean that they're going to be quotas on Jews? It's a zero-sum game, some people argued. Bring in the African Americans, They'll exclude us. And of course, I must tell you, my own institution, Union College in Schenectady, New York, built in 1795, from 1920 to 1965, had a quota on Jews. No more than 8 to 10% of any incoming class could be composed of Jews. Harvard did it. Columbia did it. Lots of schools did it. Union did it as well. That's the mountain that top that really hovers over us in the American Jewish community. So, when all is said and done, the relationship and the alliance is greatly frayed. It really is. But at the end, or as they say now, my students like to say it almost ad nauseum, at the end of the day, or in the end, in the final analysis, the relationship may be frayed, but it will not be destroyed because of the common ground that blacks and Jews share. I told you about the prophet Isaiah. Jewish social ethics. Is it because it's in the genes? Who knows? It isn't in the genes, of course. Jewish history and the Jewish religion have moved the Jews in the direction of social justice. They will always support civil rights. And the African-American community knows what the Jews know. Those who hate blacks hate Jews. Those who hate Jews hate black Americans. And when it comes to economic issues, again, we look at it a bit differently, but in the end, we come together. Any Jew that knows his or her history knows this. As the night follows the day, a deteriorating economy and rising unemployment eventually lead to anti-Semitism. That's a historical axiom. And for the African-American community, what's the old rule of thumb? If the unemployment rate is 7% for the general public, it's almost twice that for the African-American community. The result is, for civil rights, for economic issues, for our place in American society, the relationship is frayed. There's too much bad water under the bridge. But it will not sunder. It will not break. And because it will not break, Jews and blacks can play a role in making the 21st century the best century in American history. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Stephen Burke, the Henry and Sally Schaefer Professor of Holocaust and Jewish Studies at Union College in Schenectady, New York, former chairman of the Department of History, director of the program in Russian and Eastern European Studies, and faculty advisor to the Jewish Student Organization. He is the author of Year of Crisis, Year of Hope, Russian Jewry and the Pogroms of 1881 to 1882, published in 1985 by Greenwood Press. Dr. Burke spoke on the topic, Our People Are Your People, American Jewry and the Struggle for Civil Rights, 1954 to 1965. His remarks were given as the annual Phil and Ruth Sokoloff Lecture, co-sponsored by the Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, November 1st, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, UNO Media Relations Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.